War and Peace by Sergei Bodarchuk, and that's out from Criterion, Blu-ray, DVD and stuff. And that's it for me. So back to you, DK.
Thank you, Matthew. Great stuff as usual. And that's it for the show this week. We will be back next week with another new episode with new reviews of streaming and DVD releases.
This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series where we get to profile some of the amazing recordings in our over 55,000 program collection going back to 1949. I'm your host, Mark Torres. On this edition of From the Vault, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Pacifica Radio Archives recordings from 1968. As part of our ongoing preservation and access program, the Pacifica Radio Archives identified some 100 of our most outstanding recordings from 1968. Some of the voices you will immediately recognize. Some you won't. Some sound like they are 50 years old. Some sound like they were recorded this morning. They represent how things have changed so much and how we haven't changed much at all. I've also selected some choice music from 1968 to help move the story along. Or as Ray Bradbury says,
you've got to write poetry about it and music about it so that in turn some slow transformation of the political picture can occur.
From the Vault presents the recorded history of 1968 from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Dr. Spock was a pediatrician and the best-selling author of Baby and Child Care. He eventually became a major force in the anti-war movement.
Our government president tells us that we are there at the request of the Vietnamese people, that we're fighting for democracy, that we're yearning to make peace, and are so sad that we've gotten no response from the government of North Vietnam and from the National Liberation Front. All of this is completely untrue. The United States was never invited into Vietnam. The United States conceived of this as a power play in 1954 after the French were defeated. And the United States, without invitation, found Diem in the United States and moved him to South Vietnam and installed him as our puppet without ever consulting the people in any way.
Rainbow rising in the street, oh.
Madame T. Bean from the Vietnamese delegation at the 1968 Paris Peace Talks.
Madame Nguyen T. Bean has no illusions about the future. Yes, she said as she told me goodbye, I know when I go home it will get worse. And then, to comfort me, she said, but do not worry, Madeleine, our spirit is very strong. Only tell your people to go home.
Long time since I climbed down this mountain before. Things I've seen here make me want to go running.
The Pacifica Radio Archives is preserving the social history of the last half of the 20th century. These programs are now available to the public thanks to our Preservation and Access Project. To find out more, visit our website at pacificaradioarchives.org.
Madame Bean, why does the National Liberation Front ask to be the sole representative of South Vietnam?
Tại sao Mặt trận Dân tộc Giải phóng miền Nam Việt Nam?
To answer this question, I shall first deal about how the National Front was born and about its position.
Đều để đứng lên đấu tranh để chống lại.
From 1954, faced to the policy of repression and terrorism by the Saigon administration, backed by the U.S. government, all the peoples of the Vietnamese, of South Vietnamese people, from workers, peasants, to intellectuals, industrialists and traders, to religious people, all have risen up to struggle against them.
Pacifica legend Dale Miner reporting from the battle in the city of Hue, Vietnam in February 1968.
5,000 Marines with an additional complement of Arvin Rangers dig in under constant artillery, rocket, and mortar fire against the day possibly only hours away when the long-awaited big crunch begins. Constant is probably too strong a term for the present North Vietnamese artillery harassment of the Khe Sanh base. Intermittent would be more accurate. But it is constant in the sense that it's always there. A walk down the road from one bunker to another is as likely to be made with a detour into a trench as not, as a not-so-distant boom warns one of an approaching round, or the crack and zing of a sniper's bullet reminds one that not only is the base in its entirety under direct NVA observation, but every yard of it is in small arms range of North Vietnamese troops, who daily draw their ring tighter about it. Such reminders are constant at Khe Sanh, and so for periods of the night is the shelling itself. But probably the most dramatic reminder is the trip in and out. It is a trip many here do not want to make at all. It is a trip very few want to make twice, and it is not one recommended for those who are nervous in airplanes to begin with.
The Pacifica Radio Archives houses the history of the Pacifica Foundation, founded in 1949 with the birth of KPFA Radio, 94.1 FM in Berkeley, California. The Pacifica Radio Archives has over 50,000 programs dating back to 1949.
You know, I woke up this morning, people. First thing I did was to look into your eyes. In that space where I used to find so much truthfulness, it was a stone cold pack of lies. You know, there's something.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh on his breaking story of the My Lai Massacre in Vietnam, 1968.
This is Steve Bookchester in Washington with another edition of Pacifica's Military Monitor. My guest today, and happy to have him back, is Seymour Hersh, whose new book, My Lai 4, A Report on the Massacre and Its Aftermath, will be published by Random House on May 11th. Cy, in your book, you quote a member of Charlie Company named Herbert Carter as saying the people didn't know what they were dying for and the guys didn't know why they were shooting them.
What happened at My Lai, of course, in my personal opinion, was not an isolated incident, and I don't think very many people who seriously study the war would disagree with that. Perhaps we killed 400 or 50 or 500 people there. Perhaps we haven't killed that many in one specific instance before, but it's happened. What we've done with My Lai 4 and what the Army has done in a way by charging this Lieutenant Calley was the fact that this lieutenant was charged that enabled the papers to initially publish the stories that I was writing last year. What we finally, I think, done is surface the, you know, you might say the cancerous fingernail of what's going on in Vietnam, and the whole public can take a look.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Expediency asks, the question, is it politic? Vanity asks, the question, is it popular? But conscience asks, the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. And that is where I stand today, and that is where I hope you will continue to stand so that we can speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters all over the world and righteousness like a mighty stream. And we will speed up the day when men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nations will not rise up against nations, neither will they study war anymore. And I close by saying, as we sing it in the old Negro spiritual, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow man. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame legend and counterculture leader Joan Baez.
I think women can and should sign the complicity statement and make a public thing out of it, you know, make some kind of program out of it. And I think that you can aid and abet. The other night, a guy came up to me at a draft card turn-in and said, "Would you do me the honor and hand me his card?" You know, while I would hold it while he burned it. Well, I was absolutely overjoyed. It was like looking at my first Christmas tree, you know. And the women really, excuse me, David, but hold together the resistance in the back rooms on the typewriters and the stamp licking and all that stuff that goes on. I mean, there's plenty for you to do. Lastly, I would just like to say that I don't think any woman should go to bed with a man who carries a draft card.
Pacifica Radio Archives is preserving the social history of the last half of the 20th century. Many of these recordings are presented in the Archives' original weekly series, From the Vault. To find out more, go to fromthevaultradio.org.
Coretta Scott King, reading the Ten Commandments against the war in Vietnam. She pulled these notes from the pocket of her dying husband and read them at his memorial the next day in Manhattan's Central Park, April 5th, 1968, and Pacifica Radio again was there to record it.
My dear friends of peace and freedom, I come to New York today with a strong feeling that my dearly beloved husband, who was snatched suddenly from our midst slightly more than 3 weeks ago now, would have wanted me to be present today. Though my heart is heavy with grief from having suffered an irreparable personal loss, my faith in the redemptive will of God is stronger today than ever before. As many of you probably know, my husband had accepted an invitation to speak to you today. And had he been here, I am sure he would have lifted your hearts and spirits to new levels of understanding in his customary fashion. I would like to share with you some notes taken from my husband's pockets upon his death. He carried many scraps of paper upon which he scribbled notes for his many speeches. Among these notes was one set which he never delivered. Perhaps they were his early thoughts for the message he was to give to you today. I am sure he would have developed and delivered them in his usual eloquent and inspired fashion. I simply read them to you as he recorded them. And I quote, Ten Commandments on Vietnam.
The murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope to gain? Will my country fall, stand or fall? Is it too late
for us all. And did Martin Luther King just die in vain?
Thou shalt not believe in a military victory. Number two, thou shalt not believe in a political victory. Number three, thou shalt not believe that they, the Vietnamese, love us. Number four, thou shalt not believe that the Saigon government has the support of the people. Number five, thou shalt not believe that the majority of the South Vietnamese look upon the Viet Cong as terrorists. Number six, thou shalt not believe the figures of killed enemies or killed Americans. Number seven, thou shalt not believe that the generals know best. Number eight, thou shalt not believe that the enemy's victory means communism. Number nine, thou shalt not believe that the world supports the United States. Number 10, thou shalt not kill.
He was for equality for all people. Love and goodwill, hate was not his way. He was not a violent man. Tell me, folks, if you can, just why was he shot down the other day? Folks, you'd better stop and think and feel again, for we're headed for the brink. What's gonna happen now that the king of
you're listening to From the Vault, the original weekly series produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For more information, go to fromthevaultradio.org. The preservation of our programs recorded decades ago are delicate and in need of special attention. Some of these programs were carefully shipped on temperature and humidity-controlled trucks from our home in Los Angeles, California, to the Safe Sound Archives, nestled in the cobblestone neighborhood of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. George Blood is the proprietor of this special facility and supervises every tape that we send him. In 2008, he was in Los Angeles for his first tour of the Pacifica Archives, and we had the opportunity to get his impression of our facility and collection.
Most collections are much smaller. We've seen other collections of this size. This is what we do for a living. We get to see a lot of material, but it's definitely on the upper end of collections that we work with. On the upside, the materials weren't just sitting on a shelf sequestered in a vault somewhere. protected by some nice old lady with a bun that you had to make special requests to get to. But they're clearly in use in this very active area outside the vault where the tapes are kept. These are clearly originals. This is all source material that's being cut up and put into the reels. And that means the fidelity of the tapes that we're seeing, because they're first generation, is generally pretty good. Other things like the splices fail, we see in all collections. It's not particular to these tapes that were put together in a rush and run down the hall to be put on the air. So there aren't very many surprises, although, you know, is it all nice, spiffy, clean, like somebody was handling it with white gloves in these beautifully typed boxes? No, it looks like something that's living.
What would be the benefit to the average listener if those programs were all digitized and up on some server where people could access them easily?
I think that that can be summed up in the tagline that we use for the company, you know, Safe Sound Archive, preserving the sound of history. And so much of history, of very important periods of American history, are preserved on those tapes from Pacifica Radio. And to be able to be in such direct contact, it's one thing to read a transcript or read somebody's account or read a book or history book about it. But when you hear these tapes of somebody's out in the middle of, you know, whatever with a microphone, where you have a producer or announcer responding to the challenges of today, putting that in a context, that's something that's conveyed in these tapes and puts a real sense of being there, much greater than just reading it off the page. It's pretty impressive.
We now continue with The Recorded History of 1968 from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Stanley Kubrick in 1968 commenting on his groundbreaking film 2001: A Space Odyssey.
The most controversial film to be made in some years, and oddly enough, an American one. Stanley Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey.
The motion picture 2001: A Space Odyssey is based on a story by Arthur C. Clarke titled The Sentinel.
Well, for me, the film is a brilliant examination of what will happen when man comes up against a truly superior intelligence.
Brilliantly successful as a film which creates a world which really doesn't exist and won't exist for another 40 years. I think that it's superlative, that there's been nothing like it ever made.
The HAL 9000 computer, which can reproduce, though some experts still prefer to use the word mimic, most of the activities of the human brain, and with incalculably greater speed and reliability. We next spoke with the HAL 9000 computer, whom we learned one addresses as HAL. Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
This is a pre-recorded briefing, which for security reasons of the highest importance has been known on board during the mission only by your HAL 9000 computer. 18 months ago, the first evidence of intelligent life off the Earth was discovered.
Well, it's the first, of course, really major film on science fiction. There have been many science fiction films in the past. Most of them are the low-budget affairs, and very few of them any good indeed, though there have been some, I think, very fine efforts. But this is the first Cinerama movie in this area, and of course the theme of space travel is uniquely suited for the screen. It's a very big budget movie. It cost more than $10 million, partly because of the extraordinarily detailed special effects, which are of quite unprecedented. Everybody who's remarked about the movie said some of the effects are unbelievable, and that's why it took more than 4 years to do. Nevertheless, the special effects and the spacecraft, all the different types of space stations and space vehicles, are only the background for the theme of the film, which is man and the universe, or if you like, man and God, and that's the interpretation many people have put on it.
Pacifica Radio Archives has over 50,000 programs dating back to 1949. These programs are now available to the public thanks to our Preservation and Access Project. To find out more, visit our website at pacificaradioarchives.org.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
President Johnson raised a question some weeks ago when he was giving his State of the Union address. He talked of all of the beautiful television sets that we have over the nation. In fact, he gave the number, about 70 or 80 million. He talked about the beautiful automobiles and the massive expressways that will hold our automobiles up and keep them flowing. He talked about the number of automobiles, new automobiles, that come out every year. And he said after that, yet that is questioning in the land. That is a strange restlessness. And I guess he raised the question because he didn't quite know what was wrong. Well, there is something radically wrong. And I suspect it is that in all too many instances, we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. We have maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. And so we've ended up with guided missiles and misguided men. And I guess that's the basis of the questioning and the restlessness facing this generation. Our nation is in a mess. The world is in a mess. Now the question is, what do we do? And I must confess that I have no pretense to omniscience. I don't know everything, and the answers are hard to find today because of the great ambiguities of life and history. But we have to do something. Marlon Brando also mentioned the riot report, the Kerner report, that came out a few days ago. And it said some things to us that we cannot ignore. Some of us have been saying these things all along, but nobody paid much attention to them. Now, maybe after they have now been said by a presidential commission, and now that these things have the halo of respectability about them, maybe some people will listen. But in gloomy and realistic terms, that report pointed out that our nation is moving toward two societies, one white and one black, separate and unequal. And the fact is that with this kind of move taking place, hatreds are deeper, tensions are greater, misunderstanding will be wider. But the commission report didn't stop that. It brought out another thing that is often painful to hear, and yet it must be heard if the problems that we face in our nation are to be solved. And that is the fact that racism is still at the center of our nation. We must honestly face the fact that America is a racist society. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of an inferior people. It is a tragic notion that one group has all of the worth and all of the knowledge, all of the significance, all of the purity, and another group has all of the inferiority, the worthlessness, and the impurity. And whenever racism is a basic philosophy, whether it is expressed overtly or whether it is subconsciously or latently
held. It always brings into being an absolute disrespect for human personality. Now, the first thing that must be on the agenda of our nation is to get rid of racism in all of its dimensions. And it means that white America will have to do something positively, affirmatively, and meaningfully in order to bring all of God's children into the mainstream of the life of this nation. It cannot be done short of something massive. And it means that those who have not known the pathology of the ghetto will have to somehow take that empathetic journey and join hands with those who have been denied and who have been hurt and who have been exploited for so many years. Massive programs are needed. And that means billions of dollars. And the question is whether the affluent part of America is willing to make the sacrifice so that everybody will be able to live a creative life.
Author and humanitarian James Baldwin.
Ralph Ellison told you a long time ago, long before I did, what it was like to be the invisible man. And his long, long record, going back to the auction block, of what we really feel, we the blacks in this country. And what we really feel, we the blacks in this country, is a mirror of what you really feel. That's why we really feel that way.
Well, Mr. Baldwin, I don't feel qualified myself to speak on behalf of all white Americans, and I
wonder... But on the other hand, if I may interrupt you, I don't feel qualified to speak on behalf of all black Americans either. But it's very interesting that I would find myself in this position, and the only reason I am in this position is because all black Americans are treated like niggers. Sammy Davis Jr. to my mother. Now, what I'm trying to say to you is you can't really say that you're not qualified to speak on behalf of all white Americans if I'm treated the way all black Americans are treated in this country.
You still feel yourself treated in that fashion?
As long as my brother is, and I have four brothers and five sisters, and my mother is, and many, many more people than that are treated as they are. By being in the Beverly Hills Hotel has nothing to do with it.
But there are such dramatic exceptions, Mr. Baldwin, yourself being...
There are no exceptions.
Leontine Price...
There are no exceptions.
No exceptions?
No.
You're saying, in effect, then, that as long as black Americans
if they
are
don't know that
you are mistreated.
If they don't know that she's Leontine Price, she still can't get a taxi.
The Pacifica Radio Archives houses the history of the Pacifica Foundation, founded in 1949 with the birth of KPFA Radio, 94.1 FM in Berkeley, California. The Pacifica Radio Archives has over 50,000 programs dating back to 1949. These programs are now available to the public thanks to our Preservation and Access Project.
Author, screenwriter, and visionary Ray Bradbury.
It is a fact that the more we increase our armaments, the Soviet Union, China, and the United States, the more we increase our armaments, the more we decrease our national security. Every single scientific advisor to every president from President Eisenhower on down has said this and has said further, there is no technical solution to this contradiction. It's a political problem. The United States must wake up to this political fact. And yet we won't.
We are not your friends. We don't give a damn for what you're saying. We're here to live our lives. We are hungry men.
The cradle was rocked when the king was overthrown and the government of Mr. Papadopoulos took over.
In 1968, Pacifica station WBAI in New York aired the voices commenting on the fascist takeover of Greece.
The present so-called government of Greece, the junta, has obviously not the support of the left politically, not the support of the center, but very importantly, it also lacks support from the political right. That is, it has no support at all. And the only thing that's keeping it up, really, is the United States government.
Academy Award-nominated Greek actress Melina Mercouri made herself available to comment on the right-wing takeover of her home country of Greece. Pacifica Radio was there to record her.
I called the consul of Greece here in New York, Mr. Gavas, and I say tomorrow I will be in the television, in the news, and I will denounce the junta. And then he said to me that if I don't stop to talk, then I will be punished. And I laughed, and I say, why, you will kill me?
As many of you may know, Melina Mercouri lost her Greek citizenship shortly after the military coup in Greece last year because she was outspoken and quite articulate and quite vocal in opposition to the military takeover and in opposition to the fascist regime which took over. Instead of silencing her, the taking away of her Greek citizenship has made her even more vocal and more determined to continue to fight for the restoration of democracy in Greece.
Ελευθερία ή θάνατος, το λάβαρο μας γράφει.
I have received thousands and thousands of letters from unknown people all over America expressing their love for my people and my country. And I have wept more than once when I found in the envelopes $1 or $5 with the words, "Dear Melina, please use this to help the return of democracy to Greece." And when I walk in the streets, people come to greet me and say, "Give them hell, Melina. Give those fascists hell." I cannot tell you the comfort and the courage that has been given to me by the American people. So how painful it is to me to deplore the official American position. I urge you to write to your president. I urge you to write to your State Department and your representatives. Believe me, they want to hear from you. They have told me so. Military aid to Greece must stop. Economic aid to Greece must stop. Tourism to Greece must stop. American investments to Greece must be discouraged, not encouraged. Acts of barbarism must stop. Political prisoners must be freed. Democracy must return. Civil war must be prevented. I urge you to act now. Time is not on our side. Thank you.
This is H-Rap Brown, and good afternoon. So black people this year, young black people, like Thomas Smith, John Carlos, mounted the victory stand, which they rightfully won, and wearing black gloves, black socks, no shoes. And when the Star Spangled Banner was played, they clenched their fists in an act of defiance, saying that, yes, we are black. Carlos likened the white attitude toward black athletes to the relationship between trainers and show horses or elephants. If we do a good job, he said, they'll throw us some peanuts or pat us on the back and say, good boy.
Olympic gold medalist John Carlos talked about the action in 1975 with sports sociologist Jonathan Brower on KPFK Los Angeles.
American athlete John Carlos, who raised his black gloved fist with fellow track and field medal winner Tommy Smith at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. Carlos recounts his actions to symbolically unite blacks and minorities and to protest the double standards of living conditions and law enforcement. John Carlos and Tommy Smith among the earliest athletes who took a stand against social inequality and injustice.
We just wanted to let black people throughout the world know, you know, that we ran representing them. We were trying to tell black people and minority people that they're going to have to become more united to stand against the struggles that they have in front of them. And all the words in the national anthem didn't cover black people or minority people. And I didn't feel that I should go up and stand up at attention and applaud something I disagree with totally. You know, I'd be being hypocritical to myself.
Before his death in 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called on a broad coalition of community leaders to address the poverty crisis in America. This effort took the form of what they called the Poor People's Campaign, and although Dr. King wouldn't live to see this campaign through, many of the coalition did, like Chicano movement leaders Reyes Lopez Tijerina, Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez, Bert Corona, and Jose Angel Gutierrez. Pacifica Radio was there to record the sounds from this effort that lasted from May 12th to June 24th, 1968, including Jesse Jackson delivering his now famous I Am Somebody address.
I am somebody.
God's child.
I may not have a job, but I am somebody.
I may be black, but I am somebody.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream.
We continue now with coverage of events that occurred earlier today in connection with the Yippies and the national mobilization to end the war in Vietnam. Here is Allen Ginsberg.
The conditions in Chicago at present are very similar to the authoritarian Marxist conditions in Prague in 65 and 68 today. The ban on demonstrations proposes violence. The state proposes violence when it doesn't allow younger people to assemble calmly and peacefully without the sound of motorcycles.
Pacifica Radio Archives has over 50,000 programs dating back to 1949. These programs are now available to the public thanks to our Preservation and Access Project. To find out more, visit our website at pacificaradioarchives.org.
There are two Democratic Party conventions in Chicago in August of 1968. One is inside the International Amphitheater with banners and placards and gavels and speeches. The other is in the streets and parks of Mayor Richard Daley's city with tear gas and rocks and mace and clubs, and most of all, with blood. And a cloud marked Vietnam hangs over both. tangling them together. Separate the strands. Go back to a snowy winter in New Hampshire, when a northern senator named Eugene McCarthy tramps the streets, braves the cold, and challenges a president.
Which I challenge a Democratic president. I challenge a particular policy in Vietnam.
Move forward to a spring day when another senator, this one named Kennedy, announces he too will seek to take the nomination from the president.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States.
Come forward a bit more when that president tells the nation he will not seek re-election.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Go to Los Angeles, where one man wins an election and loses his life.
Yeah, there's a pool of blood on the ground, naturally. I think he was shot in the
head. With that chronicle, come to Chicago in August of 1968. Come as a delegate with the proper credentials to get you past the police, into the amphitheater, into the hotel suites and the delegations. Hear the talk of Eugene McCarthy, the name of Edward Moore Kennedy, the politics of joy of Hubert Humphrey. Feel the unseen presence of Lyndon Johnson. Or come to what they are calling the Festival of Light, the street theater, the anti-war demonstrations, the hippies, the yippies. Into the park, smell the incense, the marijuana, hear the music, hear the speeches, hear the laughter. Inside or outside, take your choice. Some of the delegates inside take offense at Chicago Mayor Richard Daley's tactics both inside the amphitheater and outside in the streets. Daley, himself a delegate, uses tactics inside the hall that are reminiscent of what his police are using outside. When the delegates protest, Mayor Daley tries to adjourn the convention, and the protest grows.
Will the convention be in order? Will the sergeant at arms enforce order in the convention? Will the convention be in order? Will the convention be in order? Because may the chairman make a brief statement. May I make a brief statement? It is not in order to make a general motion to adjourn, because that would kill the convention. The chair would gladly recognize the distinguished mayor of the city of Chicago to adjourn to a time certain, such as 12 o'clock tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, I move to adjourn to 12 o'clock tomorrow.
The question is on the motion. So many as in favor, vote aye.
Aye!
Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. Accordingly, the House stands adjourned until 12 o'clock noon tomorrow.
Convention Chairman Carl Albert. Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon describes the major conflict in the platform on Vietnam.
Issues whether or not the Democratic Convention is going to vote today to continue to kill American boys in South Vietnam. We can't possibly justify this killing of our boys. We've got to have a change in policy, and I hope the Democratic Party will take advantage of the opportunity to unite the party, and they'll never unite this party unless they change the policy in Vietnam.
But the convention refuses to heed Morse's words. It votes a plank supporting President Johnson's Vietnam War policies.
This is our trouble today. All Negro, so-called Negroes worry about his money.
Muhammad Ali from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
He's like the white man now. He'll blow up his mama for some money and sell out his people for some money. That's why we're nowhere today, because all the big Negroes with some money is up on the hill with the white folks. riding with the white folks, going to church with the white folks, marrying the white folks, shuffling and tomming and loving white folks, and they forget all about the brother down there in Harlem, his rent's due, living in a bad home, standing on the corner, nobody know him, nobody want him, and he rides by in his limousine. Well, let them niggas make it like me. I can't take no chance on losing my money. Once we become followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the flesh and the blood of our people is more important than the white man's money. Money don't mean nothing if you're black to the white man. I don't care if you can buy a $500 house or a $500,000 house, you still a nigga. Now, many of our people make protests and say they're going to boycott and they're going to do this and do that. And then when the white man put the pressure on them, they back up. But I'm one who I hope and pray to Allah and his messenger, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that I be one black man that they can look at and say, turn down all $10 million in commercials, royalties. Turn down the world heavyweight title. Where is he at? There he is over there sitting on the garbage can with the wine heads. He don't have to be over there. There he is talking to the prostitute. There he is picking up the brother out alley, taking him to the Muslim temple. There he is selling a prostitute a Muslim newspaper. Ain't that something? He really don't have to do it. See, they have to look at me now greater than just in a boxing ring. Good fight, boy. White man got all the money. Two Negroes cut each other up and he pat him on the back. Good fight, boy. Great fight, boy. Good show, boy. Boy, good dancing, boy. Huh? But they can't look at me like that. See, I get all respect because I follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. You may not like Rap Brown or Stokely Carmichael, but they get more respect than the richest Negroes in America, the most white folks loving Negroes in America. When Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael walk down the tree, traffic stops. Rap Brown, where? There he is. Stokely Carmichael, where? White folks jumping out of windows looking at him, wanting to touch him. They admire warriors because they are warriors. They believe in dying and fighting for what they believe. They giving up $90 million a day in Vietnam and the guts of their children for a principle. They died and fought the Indians. Money don't mean nothing when your people are free and hungry and catching hell. So all of these so-called Negroes listen to this show. I hope you learned something from this. Damn some money when it comes to your mama's freedom. You're so quick to go to Vietnam and fight and shoot and kill somebody you don't know, fighting so they can be free, and you come home and you get your head busted. So if I gotta die, if I gotta sacrifice, if I gotta suffer, let it be for my black brothers and sisters. Let it be for my mama and not somebody 10,000 miles from here. So when you understand what I'm saying, when you weigh it out, if it means money or Tom, damn the money.
There's a train coming. Don't need no baggage. You just get on board. All we need is faith to hear the diesels humming. Don't need no ticket. We'll just thank the Lord.
Thank the Lord.
People get ready.
You have been listening to the 1968 highlights from the Pacifica Radio Archives on this edition of From the Vault. To get a copy of this program, you can call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230, or you can find it online at fromthevaultradio.org. Our theme music is by Nancy Sanchez and Gina Ricamier. I've been your host, Mark Torres. Thank you for helping keep our history alive.
for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license. Should I take another walk to the DMV? Get another learner's permit with a picture of me? I'd put it in my wallet along with my $4, and the condom that's still in there that has probably expired. I'd leave home for New York, but New York is where I'm from. I'm just looking for a way to feel my life has begun. Living in the city where I'm working like a walrus, but man, I don't need your money, man, I'm gonna be an artist. And I'm feeling like I wanna do whatever I feel inside. I put it all on paper and I'll hope that people buy it. And my only minor worry is how to pay the rent, but that won't even matter when I lose my apartment. And I'll really have no worries, I'll be just like a cassette that you've taped up the tabs of to put something new on it. And when I hit record, God only knows what I will be. And if there is no God, then it's a better mystery. Fighting for survival, and I guess I must be winning. And my story is so long, I can't remember the
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.